When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Welcome along to the Wise Men Say podcast. We are sitting in the fire station in Sunderland City Centre. I don't think we're going to bother with a preview of the Plymouth game. You can listen elsewhere if you want that, really.
I'm not doing another one.
I don't think we should ask George about what formation he thinks Plymouth are going to play at the weekend. I don't know what answer. Exactly. So.
I'm still trying to work out the Sunderland formation.
It's fine. So, myself and Gareth and Matt are here, and we are delighted to say that we are joined by George Clark, finally.
We made it happen, didn't we?
We did it. How many years ago did we first contact each other?
Six, seven,
yeah. Crikey. Should we talk about my appendix?
Well, if you want to get it out of the way first.
It just became a long topic of conversation, I noticed, on your Monday night podcast, which went on for about 15 minutes. I thought it was going to be called George Clark's Ailments.
Well, no, to be fair, it was going to be called George Clark's Amazing Ailments. were talking more about stomach removal in Turkey than your appendix, to be brutally honest.
Yeah, that's true. I did love the moment, though, when you said, yeah, we've got him on Thursday, and that would be amazing. And you just went, did you just say that?
Yeah. Can't help it, though. You should trademark that word now.
I think that might be a bit tricky, mate. Might be a bit tricky.
Right. What we'll do is we'll have a chat about the football side first.
Yeah.
And then other people are asking stuff about like the redevelopment in Sunderland and stuff, because people are interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Tell us about how you first got into football, George, and where your love affair with Sunderland started.
Well, I'm a Sunderland lad through and through, as you know. Love the club. Just like everybody up here when I was a young lad, I played tons and tons of football. Loads of football. I mean, it was like a religion, really.
Where'd you play? What position?
Do you know what? So I jumped around a bit, so I'm mainly left-footed. Which was
mainly left-footed.
Yeah, I mean, I do a bit of right foot, but not as much. I don't want to big myself up too much. I had a half decent left foot. When I first started at school, they played me left back because I was pretty tall, so I could get stuck in a little bit. Then my favourite position was left wing, and strangely enough, for a lad that's tall, I was fast. I was pretty quick, so no one expected it. They always thought like the shorter ones might have a bit more speed. So I used to skin people on the left wing. And then as I got a bit older and lost a little pace, I just went central midfield or just slightly left side of midfield. But I still drifted out on the left wing quite a lot. And then there was a point I played for a team in Gateshead when I was 16, 17. And they just stuck us up front. And they used to just belt the ball as hard and as fast as they could.
Target man.
And I was the target man. I was like a slightly shorter Niall Quinn.
Christian Speight will be signing you. You're so versatile.
He's older than 22. That won't be happening.
Well, that's true. But yeah, I was mainly left side. So left back, left side midfield, left wing.
And what about your love affair with Sunderland, the team? So, wait, were you? Because I know people always see you from Washington. Is that right?
Yeah. So I was born in Sunderland. All my family are Sunderland through and through. We lived in Pallion when I was born. I was born at the General. My nana and granddad lived in Farringdon. My other nana and granddad lived in Plains Farm. Then they moved, the Farringdon grandparents moved over to Sea Road, which is when I used to go to the old Roker Park a lot. So I was always in Sutherland, but my mum and dad moved to Washington when they were younger because it was seen as the new place to live in Washington, Newtown. So that was my patch. That's where I was brought up. But you know, between Washington and Sutherland, it was kind of 50-50. I used to spend all my weekends in Sutherland.
But being from Washington, did you used to mix with Newcastle fans at school?
Unfortunately, yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, you know what it's like in Washington. It's like 50-50. I mean, it's split right down the middle, to be honest with you. I mean, the divide was actually unbelievable. You'd go to school on a morning and half your mates would have Sunderland hats on and half of them would have Newcastle hats on. You just didn't talk to them.
And can you remember your first match?
October the 23rd, 1985, against Norwich. We got beat 2-0.
Well, I mean, that's impressive, to be honest. Could anyone else, can you remember, like, exact dates?
I can't remember the date. I remember going to a reserve game with my dad in, I think, 95.
Oh, they don't count, so those ones don't count.
Well, they've been at the end of the Roker Park season, the last Roker Park season.
I'll tell you who remembered the date really, really well was when Niall Quinn was there as chairman, and he invited me up to the boardroom, and he said, when was your first game? And I told him, because I'll never forget it. And the penny just hadn't dropped with me, and he looked at me and he went, that's 25 years to the day. Oh, I went, shut up. And he went, let me just get you a present. And he went downstairs and he nicked a tie from the players. And he went, don't wear that in the ground, because only the players are allowed to wear players' ties. And I've still got it. That was on the 25th anniversary.
And to mark the occasion sufficiently, did we lose?
Do you know what? I can't remember. I think we did, because I was quite miserable. I remember that. I can't even remember that game, actually. The older I get, the worse my memory's getting.
It'll be the 23rd of October 2000. So I'll do some Googling.
I can't see, because I just know my first game was when we were in the third division in 87-88. I was only a 6 or 7, but I remember we scored a late winner and won 2-1, but I can't remember who was against or anything.
Can I just say, though, that third division year was a great year.
I know, I was too young to appreciate that.
It's all right, you got four more couple of years.
I love that year. Because obviously, my first game was 85. So to be honest, I was 11 on my first game. If I'm really honest with you, my nana didn't want us to go to games, because obviously in the 80s, you could get a lot of hassle and a lot of trouble. And my nana's like, he's not going. And my uncle, who married into the family, so he's from London, he used to be a West Ham fan back in the day, that's where he was brought up. And then he became an absolute massive Sunderland fan, huge Sunderland fan. He took me to my first game, and I think there used to be like a little family enclosure bit or something, like a family-friendly bit in the main stand. And I remember standing in there. It's funny now because I'm 6'3", but I remember my uncle saying, I might have to build you a box to stand on, because I couldn't see, because he used to have to sit me on the railings. Oh, okay. And then we only did one game in there, and I said to him, I went, Uncle Johnny, it's really boring in here. Can we go in the Fulwell end? And that was it. I used to stand in the same spot in the middle of the Fulwell end, just halfway up, slightly to the right-hand side of middle.
You never get as far back as the cage, no?
No, I was too scared for that. My uncle couldn't go that far. My nana would have gone mental.
I remember my dad used to sit in the main stand in Roker Park, and I went to a few games at the end of that season. My mum and dad live along the street from where Roker Park was. I mentioned that reserve game because I probably told the story before. My mum was like, oh, he's not going to like it. My dad was expecting to come off 20 minutes, whatever. Went off the end of the game, didn't want to leave. Basically cried because I had to go home. He said, why are they not coming back on you? They came back on last time they went off. Well, that was half time, I feel. And there you go, I've gone ever since. I think I was 4 then. So.
I love my progression of the cage. I used to go with my dad in the middle of the full end as well, sitting in the barrier, and he was behind us, you know, that kind of set up. And I always remember, like, me older brother was in, like, and my dad was like, get yourself back the cage. And I was like a bit nervous about it. And it was when we beat Portsmouth 4-1, and I think we stopped them from getting promoted.
Yeah, I
went in there. That was the first time the cage.
Gordon Armstrong scored 2 penalties.
Yes, I think so. And it just blew my mind in the cage, and I never looked back from then. Like, that was absolutely amazing.
Well, there was Newcastle fans at the game that day because they needed us to beat Portsmouth to get in the playoffs, to get promoted.
Promoted, I think.
I remember that. Yeah. That's very.
It'll have been the Keegan.
1993, was it?
It'll have been the Keegan season when they won the league. Yeah.
So, yeah. I remember that was the last day of the season, yeah, 1-1, 4-1.
I loved the Fulwell end. I loved it. I mean, I know I can sit here as an old bloke now. You lot talk about being middle-aged all the time.
Tongue-in-cheek, we're not quite.
I've noticed you talk about being middle-aged. Well, I'm 50 this year, which is frightening, to be honest with you. I don't know how I got there. But when I look back, do you know what I loved, right, is that when you were younger, and I know this sounds really nostalgic, but if you scored a big goal, and I'd be standing there with my Uncle Johnny, by the time we'd finished the celebration, sometimes I was like 15 metres away from him because you'd go mental. You'd jump up and you'd be, or some bloke would pick us up and then I'd be in some other place. And it's, in some ways, I think it's sad with stadiums being
definitely
fully seated.
Definitely.
Like, I can understand, obviously, for massive reasons, it was right that we did that at the time after Hillsborough and everything else happened. But I don't know. I know they've talked about bringing back standing areas.
They have done quite a few Premier League stadiums are safe standing areas now.
But you're not going to have the flexibility to move around and be carried around, I don't think, because they've got the barriers in front.
You say that, but if you were at Old Trafford for the League Cup semi-final, a naked man went five rows above my head in front of me, and he got up and he was like, looked at us. And then as the ball went smashed into the roof of the net by Chicharito, and it was 1-0. And he was like, what's just happened? He was like, they've scored.
put the clothes back
on for the penalty.
Yeah, well then, who's got me under kegs? Where are they?
So he'd throw them down from a mile away. Yeah.
But they were just unbelievable days. I remember we played... God, I can't remember what year it was. Your knowledge is better than mine when it comes to dates. We played Chelsea in the FA Cup and Golden Arm.
92.
Was that the year you were born? Yeah. I hate you.
Yeah. Just for that reason,
I can't stand you. I've gone right off you.
I remember that goal clearly.
It was amazing. It was just that. I mean, literally, the full end just went mental. And that was one of the greatest nights I had at the stadium, actually. We had quite a few. But yeah, it was good. So yeah, 85 all the way through to today. I've been there a few years, man.
And at what age were you like interested? We're obviously not getting on this yet, but I'm just linking it to football. So what age did you start getting interested in the architecture and stuff? And the reason I ask that is because, like, I was too young, really, when we moved to the Stadium of Light to appreciate Roker Park, I think. And it's only now, you know, like we'd see some of the old grounds like Rangers and like Everton, where the same influence has been.
Archibald Leach.
I didn't know it was Archibald or something. I didn't want to show myself up and guess. Were you appreciative of that at the time or not? Or were you still too young for that?
So my granddad was a builder, lived in Plains Farm on Primate Road, just off the Durham Road.
My neck of the woods, yeah.
And he worked on the Silsworth ski slope. So when that was being built, so when I was, God, I can't remember, I was like 8 years old, 9 years old. My uncle Stuart, he was a footballer actually. I shouldn't say too much because he played for Newcastle. Yeah, he didn't want to, but Sunderland didn't want him, mate. He was a centre-half, he was in the Newcastle reserves. He was called Stuart Dunbar. So he played for Newcastle in the early 80s. He was like a boot boy and in the reserves. He genuinely wanted to play for Sunderland, but Newcastle came in for him.
It happened with Steve Howie, to be fair.
And then, to be honest, in the end, he emigrated to New Zealand to play football over there because he knew he was half decent, but he knew he wasn't good enough for the top teams here. Anyway, cut long story short, he used to take me up to see my granddad on building sites. I just love being around building and construction. I used to sketch and draw a lot when I was a kid. I was always slightly artistic and just it all came together when I was about 12, and that's when I knew I wanted to be an architect. So I knew about building and construction. If I'm honest, I didn't know what architecture was. Like, I didn't really understand what the word even meant. And my granddad bought I think Sunderland Library had a book sale on, and he paid 10 pence and bought the glossary of architectural terms. That's how much of a geek I was at 12. And then I realised, like, genuinely, hand on heart, from 12 years old, I just knew I wanted to be an architect, and that was it.
And did you appreciate Roker Park at the time for that or not? Or was that, yeah, was that
no, a no, bit... I did. I mean, do you know what? I even worked on the refurb of Roker Park when I was 16, 17. So on my apprenticeship, I worked for an architect in Washington called David Johnson Architects. And I don't know how David got the job, because he was like a one-man band architect.
That would be one.
Cheap, that's what it was. That's Bob Murray just not part with his money.
Who put this silver tap here?
Where's the gold taps?
And so it's all upgrades, you know, kind of post Bradford's fire, post Hillsborough and stuff like that. So it's about, I mean, it wasn't exciting stuff. It was about making emergency exit routes. You know, the police control room down at the Roker End. I worked on that. Can you remember the emergency staircases that went off the main stand? You probably don't.
Yes, yes. They're like they used to curve round.
Yeah, I did the drones for them, really, mate, back in the day.
Wow.
Even the toilets. So it's 16, 17. I remember being on site. I think Toland, the contractors, did the job. I even remember one bloke just going, "You from the architect?" And I was 17 years going, "We need a decision on this." And I'm thinking, "I'm going to get sued." And but you know what? It was a dream come true. That, like, no bullshit at all. For me to love that ground like I did, and be going there since I was 11, and all of a sudden be doing drawings for it and being part of the architecture of it. And I think what you appreciate with any stadium, to be honest, is you realise how important a piece of architecture it is to the people that go there every week or every couple of weeks. Do you know what I mean? It is a religion. It's like going to a cathedral when you're in there, to be honest with you. And it means so much to everyone. I mean, even now, just us talking about it, I remember going to I think there was an England under-15s game or something. And I got on the bus from Washington, you know, got off at the Wee Chief, walked to the game, bought tickets for that, stood in the Roker End, which I didn't normally do, and watched that game, and all that stuff just sticks with you. So you realise how important, I mean, come on, Roker Park wasn't the best piece of architecture in the world, as we know. It was just kind of built randomly in sections over many years. But it's about what a building means to people, and that's the most important thing, I think.
The main and the clock stand were individual, or altered, I don't know if that's the right word or not.
It's actually iconic with that, the lattice work.
Like you still got that Rangers, Everton.
Well, Plymouth have just pulled theirs down. Did Plymouth have the same one on their old main stand? I'm not sure if it did.
I'm not sure.
But you, one of my daftest memories actually is how many bloody columns got in the way that would ruin your sight line. So you used to see in the Fulwell end that there'd be this like little gap of people not standing there because you knew that's where the column was. Luckily all that stuff's gone.
So you still get that at Goodison Park, don't you?
Yeah.
You used to get that at Highbury as well, I remember. It was really bad. Highbury would actually, there would be a seat and they went behind that column,
it's
like literally behind it. Absolutely.
There's one in the Empire next door. Yeah, me dad went to see something with my dad, and we bought these restricted view seats thinking, oh, it'll be all right. And he had
restricted view seat, mate. There's something in the title of that ticket sale.
Well, usually it's like, but this was like no view at all. Like, usually you're expecting, like, you know, oh, I might not be able to see.
Did you get discount on it or something?
Have
you ever been back at the Bullens Lane end at Everton? If you're at the back of that stand,
Anfield Road
underneath, it's basically like watching a game through a shed window. Yeah. It's like you can't see anything. If the ball goes in the air, the ball goes to the back post.
The Anfield Road, the finished back of that, before they did the extension on the top, if you sat in the back five rows, you couldn't see the other goal. So I remember going midweek thinking, well,
I love the idea that instead of restricted view tickets, they might advertise no view tickets.
It wasn't so really they had no view of the state.
It was just for a big game.
A massive disclaimer on the back.
I was all right. He had that one. Yeah. So it's fine.
I was going to say, so you would have, how old would you have been when we moved?
God, when did we move?
90, summer of 97.
Yeah.
Summer I left school, see, so it syncs together.
I'll have been 23.
So do you remember, what was your thoughts then? Obviously, so you've been in that world for 6-7 years, working in that world. What was your sort of thoughts from a football perspective and like an architectural perspective, moving to the new stadium? Did you go to the little shed that was next to the building site and like look at the designs and where the video screen, where you could see where you could sit?
It was interesting because, do you know what, I didn't see any of that. It happened quite quick. If I'm honest, by then, I moved down to London in 96. And that's when I became a little bit detached from the club. I mean, obviously, I watched as many games as I could, and I've always been obsessed with the club. But that's kind of when I stopped going to games.
The best period.
Yeah.
I know.
It's Sunderland to do that.
I've moved down to London. I went to University College London. It's a geographic thing. Like, genuinely, I just didn't come back up as much as I wanted to at the time when I was at university. So I was doing my masters, and it was pretty intense at UCL. But yeah, at the time in the football was absolutely brilliant. I wasn't watching it.
When's the first time you? Do you remember the first game you went to at the stadium, Elias?
God, I think it was about. I can't remember the exact game. It must have been about 99, 2000, I think, was the first game. I don't remember. No, that's not true, actually. I think the stadium.
You must have went that first season. You would have.
I think I'd gone that first season.
You must have made.
I think only came up for a couple of games. I can't quite remember. But when I started properly reconnecting and coming back up for more and more games, because basically I was at UCL, my course was pretty intensive. It was full on. It was actually quite horrible, to be honest. It was that stressful. So I was there from 97 to 99. So I was just fully consumed in the course, really. And then I set my practice up in January 2000. You know, I went off to like the desert and thought in America and came back and just thought, right, I'm not working for anybody ever again. I'm going to set my own business up. So I was all consumed in that. So I think I'd been there the first season a few times, not that many. And then there was a big, big gap. And my uncle, who I used to go to the games with, he moved away, moved down to Somerset. So there was a period of time where I wasn't connected as much as I would have loved to have been, to be honest. And then about 2000, I came back in again.
When the first time you went, though, did you go in and did you have an architect head on going?
Well,
like,
did I walk in and say, is it amazing?
Yeah.
Is that what you want to know?
No, I didn't say that. I mean, if you did, I'd be worried. I mean, you wouldn't be as successful as you have been. But
do you know why the title Amazing Spaces came out? So we, first season, making that series, didn't have a title. Right? We had no title at all. In fact, someone had like a terrible working title where they called us. And I was like embarrassed. They call it micro designs because you had grand designs micro designs. And I was like, that's horrific. That. And it was so they got in the edit and they'd been in the edit for about 4 or 5 months. And it was purely because when they were watching all the footage, I would walk in and go, that's amazing. That.
Cheers.
You've got to edit this.
We'll leave that in.
But it was right on the. The line.
The guy who came up with the micro spaces. Yeah. He's like, I'll bloody get you on that.
Micro designs, man. It was
as he was delivering the bit about saying something was amazing.
And it was purely because I would walk into spaces and go, that's an amazing space, that's amazing. And someone at the channel went, this is called the George Clark's Amazing Spaces. So that's how it came about.
Did you hear Gareth? You said you listened to the pod. Did you hear Gareth mention how I always just suggest a bar should go everywhere?
He mentioned the George Clark's Amazing Bars, and I'm well up for making that.
The best
one
being.
I think we should start right here, actually.
The best one being when Barry Hyde was showing us around the, he's got loads of like music studios in the Peacock and stuff like that,
yeah.
And took on the terrace, and I was like, it would be absolutely mint to put a bar here because it's a great terrace and stuff. And Gareth was like, you actually now suggesting that they put a bar in a bar.
That's how fucking
yeah. You've gone meta at that point.
Your version could be mint spaces. Yeah. That can just be your phrase from now on.
How'd that transition come to you? Because I bet when you're talking there and you're saying you were obsessed with it when you were younger, got to work on Rocker Park, which you said was a dream come true, still really young. So you're obviously focused, and so you probably didn't surprise yourself that you were going to do quite well. But I bet you never thought...
I never thought
I'd be on the telly. I'll do this on the telly. No. So how did that transition happen?
I always had a passion for architecture and buildings, as we've talked about before. The fact that I'm on telly now is kind of weird, really. I hated school plays. I couldn't stand drama. All I was interested in at school was design, any design course, art sculpture course. Loved English, loved history, and football, PE. I mean, even on PE, if they said you're playing rugby, I just wouldn't do it. Even my granddad said, that's a sport that's been invented for lads that can't play football.
Yes.
I mean, what's the scrum all about?
I just don't understand rugby at all. Don't
get Gareth started on rugby again. We've heard it many times before.
It's just terrible. Like, it's rubbish.
It's backwards. It's literally.
Yeah. So he's going to use the
word. It's wrong. It's the wrong way. kick it over, throw it out, go backwards.
And what do you think of the scrum?
I just think it's very angry.
It's very angry.
I don't understand what does the scrum do? I don't understand the point of the scrum.
It's why do they do
it's all about neck and back injuries and then just someone kicking the ball back.
I'm going to have to put a break on this little chat now because like, we do like a ramble.
Do you remember that fella in Ipswich?
Yes. When he's trying to explain rugby to us.
And then he got like really
cosy with us and thought he was going to knock about us for the rest of the night.
Yeah, he did. And then he made like, he was like, oh, the problem with like football, like, oh, all the people are horrible to each other, fans horrible to each other. And then made a homophobic comment about football fans. So it was like, we were like, all right, mate, good one. Have a nice night and left.
Yeah. Anyway, actually, the story of me getting to tell is really boring, so I'm not going to talk about it. But it was a surprise. I turned it down first. No, so, as I said, there's a long, boring story, but I went for a screen test reluctantly because I had a literary agent, I was going to write a book, and, yeah, got offered the job. I said no a couple of times, and that wasn't out of arrogance, it was just purely that my practice was really busy, I was teaching a bit.
And what was the first one? Was that amazing? Was that the first one?
No, way before that. They offered me the job to be the main presenter, and if I'm honest, I said no, because I just said, I've never presented in my life, I don't know what I'm doing, I've never been in front of a camera before, and it was probably quite astute of me at the time. Actually, I said, look, why don't you get someone else to be the main presenter, who's a presenter, and I'll be like the architectural expert. So they needed an expert to redesign people's houses, and what was good about that is, I was just like a sponge, basically, so it was like an apprenticeship for telly, so I just did my little bit. So me going and designing someone's houses is what I did for my day job. That was my job. So to just sit there and do that, whether there was a camera there or not, was straightforward for me. And then some exec who was in control of that program watched the rough cuts, because you always see like fairly early rough cuts. And the exec just went, I want him. And that was it. And then off the bat of that, I did a series called Building Your Life in the Country for 3 years, which was, to be honest, that was massive for Channel 5. And then, because that did really well, actually one or two people from Channel 5 moved to Channel 4 and then basically came in for me and nicked me from Channel 5. So yeah, I made a transfer there in 2007.
Television transfer.
I did a TV transfer to Channel 4 in 2007. First series was Restoration Man. First day's filming was January the 20-something, 2008. And then that came out 2 years later.
And what point did you stop and say, I don't need to get my hands dirty anymore now, other people can do that for me?
Oh, that was ages ago. I don't think I've ever got my hands dirty.
Getting back to football.
Are you still nervous, by the way?
No, fine. I was a bit weird.
I'm just going to drop this in there.
I'm just going to
put it out there because he comes across as being all confident, doesn't he?
Oh, well. I do a lot of public speaking and stuff.
George did a tweet and it ended with hashtag wigwam. And us in the, how can you be nervous after that?
Well,
I must admit, when I put
good
that,
nervous
when I put that tweet out, and I thought, if no one listened to your podcast on Monday night, they would think it was the weirdest tweet in the world about a kind of Turkish appendix operation, hashtag wigwam. Pick the bones out of that.
Well, there was no bones, it's very much
guts.
Yeah.
To be fair, we had people come back saying, I was enjoying all that talk there, like, because we always worried about guts. So we've been criticised before for going off on tangents, and then, like, people
were
saying, oh, I enjoyed all of that talk about that.
No, but what I loved was you basically both taking the piss that maybe my appendix operation is relatively minor and that I should have been available for the podcast in a matter of days. But what you don't realise is I got sepsis from the first operation, came out, passed out, got rushed into another hospital in London, another operation, kept me in there for another week. Wow. So when you were messaging us going, kind of like, how can you just do the podcast?
Why he agreed to come on, he was like hallucinating.
Anyway, let's move on from appendix.
And did you have your travel insurance to show them? Was it all fine?
Do you know what I was saying? I didn't even need travel insurance because it wasn't in Turkey. I didn't even know why you went down. I don't know why you went down the Turkey route. I was in Bath. I was filming and all day long I was going, I'm not right. And they were going, well, where's the pain? I said, oh, it's in the centre. And they were going, oh, well, it can't be appendix. What I didn't realise is the pain can start in the middle and then drift over. We'd gone to a hotel, had a couple of pints of Guinness, had a steak, right? And so my appendix had already burst. And I'm sitting there having a pint and steak. Wow. Thinking,
because the pain goes, apparently, doesn't it?
Goes.
Yeah.
Went to my room, and I'm thinking, I can't sleep, my gut's killing us. I was in like the fetal position by 4 a.m, and then I had to go down the hotel lobby and go, you better call an ambulance. And then I was in hospital and back for like a week. Wow. And then they released us. Two septic with sepsis. Mental. Anyway, let's
I'm not sure I'm happy with the excuse to not come on. Yeah.
No, but I just, the reason why I mentioned that is the way that you were just like digging at me a little bit.
Digging out?
There's a little bit of digging of like, how long does he need to get over a, like,
that
an
was
appendix
more
operation?
A dig at Callum Stiles than
me.
Well, it's not much of an excuse. We've had worse ones, to be fair. It's fine.
We've had worse excuse.
So do you want to talk about the team now?
Architecture, Pennick, your favourite. Who was your first favourite player? Do you remember?
I would say my proper favourite player was Marco. I mean, there were some decent players there, 85, 86. I mean, I literally, can you remember, you probably don't even know, next to Jackie White's Market, there used to be a little Sunderland shop that sold photos. I used to go in and buy photos of the players. I remember meeting Eric Gates, early days. I remember Ian Hesford turning up and bashing his car, his door into Eric Gates' car and telling me not to tell anyone because I was the only one that saw. So those are the days where I genuinely stood outside wanting autographs. I haven't got my autograph book anymore, but I had Eric in there and Steve Doyle and players like that. But Margot was, I mean, obviously we're in third division, crap league. And Marco turned up and he was just explosive. I mean, when he got the ball, he was so quick, so strong, and just smacked it. When he smacked it and it went in, we just went mental. And obviously, it was a good year because we went up straight away. But I would say Marco was my first proper year.
Do you know, Marco was in the away end. I saw him at Borough and like nobody, barely anybody recognised him. How bad is that? How old does that make you feel? Because like, he would have been, you know, like you say, I think people like the younger listeners might not realise, because people associate Marco now with just being a bit of a miserable getting on Total Sport and stuff, and they don't realise how much of a hero he was. So yeah, it was like, you know, just like Kevin Phillips sort like level, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I've never told anyone this story before, but Bob Murray became a friend of mine. Bob got in touch and we went out for lunch once, and then he made me a trustee of the Foundation of Light and stuff like that. And I'm a really, really good friend of Bob's. And he asked me who my hero was. And I said, well, obviously it was Marco. And then Bob arranged to take us to St. George's, you know, the England camp, because Bob had helped build that as well. And I turned up at his train station, can't remember which one it was. And I walked down, and Bob being the gentleman that he is, he used to always meet me at the ticket barriers. Even though he had his driver and everything else, he would always stand there waiting for me getting off the train. He was like a dad, he was brilliant, still is. And as I walked out the ticket barrier, before I got to Bob, this bloke walked past us and whacked into my shoulder. Like, you know, when you just kind of want to collide with someone. And I looked around, I thought, who the fuck is that? And it was Marco. And he brought Marco along to meet me. And then I have a tour of St. George. And I bumped into Marco. I give him the biggest hug in the world as if he was my best mate. And I'd never really met him before. And then we went off to St. George's. And I remember me and Marco having a kick around. You know, I went in goal for a bit. He went in goal for a bit. Took a few shots at each other. That was a great day. That was amazing for me. I mean, to knock the ball around with your football hero was amazing. Yeah. And those were the days where there were the Volk shirts and all that. And obviously I'm connected with Volks now in the brewery. Oh, yeah. I've invested in Volks, and those lads are doing a great job, so it all comes full circle.
They are indeed, and they are great lads, so that'll take us on, I guess, to what some people have been asking about, more about the redevelopment stuff, and we know Steve and everybody from Volks, and we do have a bit of a relationship with them.
Rescued us recently for our 10-year anniversary live. Yeah.
How did they rescue you?
We got double booked at our original venue, and we didn't find out until a week before.
Right.
And they hosted it, so we moved the venue in a week ago, and
so obviously they're good lads, but when I got in touch with them, for them to bring the Volks brand back was just brilliant. And I said to them, I said, look, I'd love to be part of it, but it's up to you, it's your thing. And they were like, no, we'd love you to be involved, so it's fantastic.
And he shared those images with us and that looks amazing. So, context. Oh, I can't, sorry, I think
I can't.
You need a trademark, I can't help it, man. I've just said it, I can't, it's right. So, what do you think of it? This just must be a really macam word.
What?
Amazing, wasn't it? Well, yeah, because I obviously keep saying it. It was called amazing. The whole show was named after it because he kept saying everything was amazing. It must be a macam thing.
And do you know what? Even my, I mean, obviously my kids are, unfortunately, London born and bred. But my daughter literally takes the piss out of me by using the word amazing. So she kind of like drops her voice and hunches up a little bit, even though she's only 16, and goes, amazing. She does, honestly.
So going back to what Gareth said about me always saying a bar should, like, suggesting places for
you're
a bar to
back
be.
To the amazing bars.
Yes.
Again.
So
you're desperate to get this away,
when you walk down Roger and head up towards Roger Park on the seafront, where that like old Mingan sort of shelter thing is, honestly, every time I walk past there, I say to my wife every time, why is not a bar there?
Well,
why is it? Why is not a bar there? And there should be like seating outdoors. Like it'll be. Oh, I nearly said a minute. I nearly fucking said it again. But it'll be really good in the summer.
Really,
and then what's happened? You also thought it was amazing. The Vox lads thought it was amazing, and that's where it's going to go.
Yes. Yeah. So that's going to open fairly soon, hopefully. And to be honest with you, we're looking at other venues as well. So the lads have got really good plans for what Vox is going to do, which I'm chuffed a bit about that. I mean, obviously Vox before was massive on the site by the river, employed whatever 700-800 people. We'll never get back to those days, but the idea that we're doing these kind of small scale micro brewery spots around the city is fantastic. I nearly said amazing.
I was going to say you used the wrong word.
I used fantastic. Well, now you're using it all the time, mate. I'm going to stick with fantastic now.
Imagine if you had said fantastic a lot and it was
George
then
Clark's fantastic spaces. Yeah, we can take in any direction you want, mate. Any descriptive word will do.
I prefer amazing to fantastic.
It's the accent, isn't it? It's the way the accent carries it, I think.
Yeah, and actually, what's brilliant is the Macam accent is even better at it, because it's a bit more like amazing. So it kind of dips down a lot with a little Y in there before it picks back up.
It's just fate. It just works. In terms of redevelopment around the stadium, so I know, like, again, we go back to when the stadium first opened, and it's in the middle of an industrial estate, which is crap, but it's actually, in comparison of the grounds of the clubs, it's really central, isn't it? And it's taken, we're getting there now, and it's taken so long to actually pull that in to the city centre. It seems so obvious, really, but it's not just easy to do that, is it? But it's starting to happen now.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously, with the shipbuilding gone and the coal mine gone and everything else, it was devastating for Sunderland, as we know, and it's been tough. And we've also got to remember, you know, we've gone through bloody austerity for years and years and years after the massive financial crash, without getting too heavy about it, you know. Then off the back of that, you've got COVID and everything else, and it's building stuff is tough. It's not as easy as you think, you know, getting the land deal sorted out, getting the money in place, making it financially stack up, it's really, really hard. There was never enough investment in the city, you know, when all that stuff was pulled and went. And it's a story, actually, that's universal across so many northern towns and cities. It's not just us, you know. But it's turned. And it's turning actually quite quickly now. There's a little bit of momentum you've had. I mean, we're in the fire station now. What a great venue. I mean, genuinely brilliant venue. But it's even started with little venues like Pop Rex. You know, the lads at Pop Rex, they asked me to go along and have a look at the building before they'd even got the building and before they had any money together. And they were like, George, will you come and have a look? And I went and met them, and I was like, it'd be brilliant if you could make this happen. I'll help as much as I can. And I connected them with a few people and stuff. And you see those kind of, those small scale things of good, cool, passionate people who want to do, if I'm honest, cultural, creative, artistic things. And that's what I think the city should be doing even more of. There's a lot of good creative people in the city who are really passionate about it, and I think those small scale kind of independent companies are going to make a massive difference to Sunderland city centre. Yeah, we've got the big stuff, obviously the Riverside developments happening, and the Vaux site's kind of planned, it's kind of funded, everyone knows what's happening there now. That's been a big thing. in for the bridges. You know, the bridges happening to connect over to the stadium. We've
been waiting 25 years for this bridge, haven't we?
Yeah, and that's frustrating for everybody. I mean, don't get me wrong, I've been coming up here for meetings for many, many years. Coming back home where I've been really frustrated that stuff hasn't happened. I mean, even Bob Murray wouldn't mind me saying it, even with the Beacon of Light, relatively small charity that was punching way above its weight. I mean, I remember like them doing a feature on the Foundation of Light on Match of the Day, and Gary Lineker absolutely raving about how good that was as a community charity, making a massive difference to the area. And when I first got connected to the charity, we just had a couple of rooms in the stadium. I mean, they gave us those for free. There was a bit of goodwill there. And then all of a sudden, we've built a 20 million quid building. And I've just been in there this afternoon, and it's flying. It's absolutely brilliant. And I think there's been a lot of doubt in the city, a lot of cynicism, and rightly so, because a lot of things were promised and never, ever happened. And all of a sudden, it's, you know, the Beacon is being built, and then you've got smaller scale stuff like Pop Rex, you've got the new City Hall, you've got the Riverside development. Just today I was taking pictures and I was like, there's loads of cranes in the middle of the city. And if there's loads of cranes, that's a really good sign, because it means you're building. And if you're building, then you're building stuff for people. And if those people are really passionate, things will change. And it's shifting. It's the first time I think I can ever say it. It's genuinely shifted the dial for the city, and that's brilliant. That,
and then the natural extension from the city centre when the bridge is made is like the Sheep Falls area, and when that's up and running, then that is an extension that would, that's suddenly just the city centre, isn't it, with a bridge in the middle. And I know you're involved with some of the stuff that's starting to happen there. I know, yeah, that would be a bigger long-term thing, but
yeah. But you said before, you said the stadium's in the middle of an industrial estate. In some ways, that was fine. Like, you know, you had the printers there, and that was a good business, and being in Sunderland for many, many years. But now making that connection properly from the city centre with those bridges to the other side in Sheep Falls, and I'm involved in a building with Sunderland College. I've got an educational charity called Moby, and we're helping with a building over there, trying to get young kids engaged in home innovation and home design. Because I think one of the biggest ambitions for the city is to build more residential properties in the middle of the city. I was saying to you before you pressed record, yeah, we've got 274,000 people in Sunderland, and there's only 3,000 people live in the city centre. Now, if you go back to places like Manchester in the late 80s and early 90s, the number of people that lived in the city centre was tiny. Now, I know Manchester's massive, and it's had a lot of investment and everything else, but the investment that went into people moving back into the city was enormous. So all the old industrial warehouses and the knackered buildings that nobody cared about, no one wanted to live in a drafty old knackered, you know, 19th century warehouse back in the day. And then certain developers went back in there and started creating, like, I was going to say amazing places there. I was just about to say amazing places. Yeah, quite amazing places in the middle of the city where people firstly started to appreciate old buildings. So they were living in buildings with a story behind them, and I love that. I've always loved that. But also, they were back in the city centre, and if you're living there, you're going to go out for a pint, and you're going to go out for some food, and you're going to start spending money. Then the shops start coming back. Cafes and bars start coming back. And that's proper regeneration. So it is the big stuff, like what's happening on the Riverside and what's happening on the Vaux site. It's also the really small stuff, like Pop Rex. Some cultural stuff. Got Culture House. Culture House, hey, is going to be a game changer, you know. I mean, that was designed by Fortner Browns that I used to work for. That is a game changer.
So that's, apart from some people upset, that's where Idols used to be, and that's a very famous Sunderland landmark. Not to look at, not aesthetically, but you know, culturally.
I could give you one or two personal stories about Idols that I'm not going to give you in case my mum listens. I remember Idols very well, like way too well, and I think I was probably underage, but let's not talk about that.
And Annabelle's, of course, upstairs.
Yeah. Well, I was even on the staircase in between a few times, but let's not talk about that. You've thrown me right off there. You take me right down memory lane. It's really good, and I mean that with all my heart. It's really, really, really good. I mean, I've been up here so many times, having so many meetings around so many sites, going, that's not going to happen, that's not going to happen, that's going to happen. And all of a sudden it's happening. It's brilliant.
When you, with work, got couple of staff in an office in the Midlands, and they came up, and I was like, I'm going to take you to Sunderland when you come up. And like the drive in, by Western Way and stuff like that, it's like, I think it's like, you can actually go, look, there's this, there's that, there's this, look at this, we're developing this, we're developing that, and you actually like, I think, for the first time in a long time, you can actually be really proud
of the city. It's interesting that you talk about Western Way. When I was a lot younger, when you went along Western Way, when the coal mine closed and everything else, before the beacon, before the stadium, before any of that, when all that was decimated and that went, it was soul destroying. I remember it. All my family, if you look at my family tree, worked in the yards and worked in the collieries, right? All of them. They were down in the shipyards, they were rope makers, sheet metal workers, all of that, or they worked down in the pit. When that got ripped down, it absolutely destroyed the place, as we know. Now, we can sit and whinge about it and hark back to the good old days and what it was all like. What's happened, happened. No point in crying over spilled milk. You've got to move on. Now, it's taken time. It's taken a long, long time. But now you go along Western Way, go past the beacon of light, go past the stadium. I know what's being planned for Sheep Falls. I'm involved in one or two other things along there. And then you go, when you go over the bridge, you know what's happening on the Vork site now. And then you turn around the corner and you've got Pop Rex and a few little small independents. Even Master Debonair, the shop. So,
like Mackie's Corner and that area.
Mackie's Corner, I mean, I went to his shop a long time ago in East Boulder, and I was like, this is class.
Lovely.
I mean, it's opposite.
My mate
Dean's just turned up, so I'm going to drop Dean in. My mate Dean lives opposite Master Debonair in East Boulder. And I used to go in there, and then he's opened up there. So I keep coming back to the same point. There's the big stuff, big infrastructure stuff. When I say infrastructure, I'm talking about the pedestrian bridges and everything else. There's the medium-sized stuff, but that small stuff, for me, is what's going to make the biggest difference.
It's a character, isn't it? It's a character of the people, brings a character to the city.
Yeah, I worked on I worked on the master plan when I was trained to be an architect for Margate, right, back in the day. I used to work for a big kind of urban design regeneration company when I was still a student, but I used to work for them part-time. And Margate was knackered. Knackered, so by the sea, off the beaten track, nobody wanted to go. The heyday of kind of coastal places and architecture had died, the fairground had gone, the amusements had gone. I mean, it was desperate. I was going there 97, 98, 99, desperate. You go now, it's flying. And that was triggered by two things. One, there was one iconic building called the Turner Centre, which is a gallery that they built right in the front. So all of a sudden you've got, you know, Turner paintings, art and culture and heritage and history there. But the main thing was all the rents were really cheap because there were so many buildings that were knackered. And young, really talented and creative people were like, hang on a minute, it's by the sea, not too far from London, not that anyone wants to be connected with that place. It's my home, by the way, now, but I'm going to get in trouble for that. And so you had these young creatives going out to the coast, beautiful spot, beautiful old buildings, lots of heritage. You could buy like a, I don't know, like a 5-bedroom Georgian building for not a lot of money in the big scheme of things. And then these young creatives have come in, lots of independent companies. A mate of mine had an idea about starting beauty products from seaweeds that you would harvest in Margate, and his company's flying now. And I think that's what Sunderland needs. It's going to have the big stuff, it's going to have the infrastructure stuff, but for me it's the young creatives retaining talent in the city and then having opportunities to go and take some good buildings. There's some great buildings around. Sunderland's got some fantastic buildings around. Now, you look around places like Sunnyside, there's some cracking old buildings around there that are ripe for redevelopment. That's what's going to make all the difference.
People won't be surprised to know that we didn't really get around to the questions or forgot about the question. I can't remember a couple of them. I think we covered a lot of what people were asking. Somebody did say something like, what would your grand design for the Stadium of Light be?
We're not talking about grand designs.
That was another question.
I've got to be careful here because I'm in the boardroom on Saturday. And I don't want to get in trouble with Kirill. I've got to be very delicate. They need to spend money on lots of spaces inside the stadium. So obviously it was built, what did we say, 97?
Yeah.
It's quite a long time ago, actually. And Bob Murray did a brilliant job.
For what the stadium costs, for what it
for
is.
For what it is.
It's amazing.
It is. That is genuinely amazing.
Yeah.
No, it was... I mean, I've got a lot of admiration for Bob Murray. I know he's had a lot of stick over the years, and bless him, he takes it. But my God, his heart's in Sunderland. I mean, he's in the boardroom with me.
I think a lot of that's changed in hindsight, though, hasn't it?
Bob loves that club, and he loves the city. And do you know what? He's been unbelievably successful in life. He could have walked away and had nothing to do with the place anymore. He's stuck with it, and he's absolutely invested in it. Not just financially, but emotionally as well. I'm a big, big fan of Bob's, actually. And in fairness to Kirill, you know, Kirill has a lot of respect for Bob, and he understands that history, and he talks to Bob quite a lot, quite regularly. And I think, if I'm honest, past owners haven't had that connection. Like, Ellis was shit.
Did he not tell him, don't give the North Stand to the Mags?
No. I'm not getting into that. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, if he was unavailable that day.
Let's just say that was unfortunate.
Not an amazing space on that day.
No, but on a really, really serious point, and I don't mind Kirill giving me stick for this on Saturday, they need to spend money on the corporate spaces and the hospitality spaces. They are looking a bit dated, and I think if you want the stadium to really be a flagship destination for concerts and events and all of those other things, you've got to raise the bar sometimes, because the competition's quite fierce out there.
But even just the regular bits where the normal fans go and stuff, it's like sometimes you look and you think you could just cover bits and cover it in a little bit more and make it a bit more homely and stuff, washes. You know. Give the roof like a jet wash for a start.
Do you ever go to other stadiums, sort of almost like from an architectural perspective, and go, that's like, so like the Tottenham Stadium, the new Wembley, stuff like that, and look in it and go, yeah, this is interesting? Or do you?
No, 100%. I mean, the problem is, in my job, it's like an occupational hazard. You're looking at everything all the time. That's why a lot of people never invite me around to their house, to be honest, because they're scared that I'm going to say.
Is that what they tell you? Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, they just don't like us.
We know what we need to do now, we just can't afford it.
Kind of bar.
Yeah, exactly. I know where the bar needs to go.
But we talked about this right at the very beginning. Stadiums are really special places. It's not just about the bits of steelwork and the cladding and everything else. It's the memories that you have of those places that's more important than anything. I mean, the new Wembley's phenomenal. I mean, I even went to see Coldplay with my daughter last summer, because she's a big Coldplay fan. It was just unbelievable as a venue. I mean, we've got to be staggeringly proud of stadiums like that. They're absolutely fantastic. And
do you think it's odd, though, because I remember going to the playoff final in the League One playoff final, and I was in the, obviously with it being League One, the corporate-y bits aren't that bothered, but so they sell the tickets in that middle bit.
Yeah.
And they had this, I can't remember, Bobby Moore bar or something, and it's great in some respects, but then at the same time, you're like, you would not know you're in a football stadium. It's a very odd, and you kind of go, well, this is really good, but like,
it's the opposite of getting passed around in the full end.
Yeah,
it's like
going to the Metro Centre,
and then there's a football stadium.
It's a balance, I guess.
Are we talking about architecture again? The architecture of bars. I'm seeing this like consistent theme that's coming about.
I'll take that architecture.
I mean, that's not a house for dogs, by the way.
No, that's my second.
It's a fairly surname. That's what it was.
That was the jewel. I mean, the other day I did put a nail in the wall, so you know.
How did that go?
Is that all right? There's water coming out of it now.
Yeah, went all right. Yeah.
And what did you hang from the nail?
Well, actually, it wasn't a nail. I put a wall plug in, some drywall, managed to hang a net for some plush toys for son, and it hasn't fallen down.
That's good. Really, I mean, that genuinely sounds amazing.
It's gone really well. Yeah, it's gone really well. So it's not quite amazing, but it's certainly a space.
Will you send me a picture?
You want.
I really want to see it.
All right, okay. I'll send you a picture later on.
what would be, quickly, just to wrap it up. So I know you said like you're going to be killing and everything like that, and you don't want to see it too much in the stadium. What would be some quick wins on the stadium, do you think? Not even like that would cost the world, just to make the experience a bit better. Putting you on the spot there.
Oh, that's a good question, Matt. It's a good question. Let's go back to bar architecture again. I would make the bars a bit better for a start.
See, that's what we're like.
We're coming back to that. a lot of the hospitality in the corporate hospitality, it needs an upgrade, if I'm honest with you. And Kirill's going to kill me for that, because he...
Well, Quinn's bar's pretty good now.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. So, yeah, I'll check it out again on Saturday, and I'll come back to you.
Give us an update.
I'll give you an update.
It is some of the rooms are dated on the boxes
but
and stuff.
That happens with... I mean, come on, it was done in 97, and even though, for me, that seems like 5 minutes ago when my first game was 1985... It's 30 years. Everything needs to be invested in and upgraded and established. And actually, I mean, without going too weird about it, like the Taylor Swift tour that got announced, and St. James's Park and the stadium alike thought they might get it, and neither of them got it. And I think that's an indicator that we need to raise our game a bit to attract like big events like that. No doubt about it.
Good. It's a good place to end. It's an amazing place to end. It was a real pleasure to get you on, George, and hopefully it's not 7 years till the next time, maybe.
Let's not leave it that long.
No, definitely not. Well, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks a lot.
And thanks always for listening.